I light this last candle for those joys and sorrows that remain in the silence of our hearts. Let's welcome Craig up.
Oh, well, before I start my reading, I need to ask, have you lost your keys? Did somebody lose their key? Sorry, I see you fumbling, but I didn't mean lost them today. I meant ever. I did the joke with the cell phone last time. I promise I'm not going to do this again. It's a miserable experience when you come to a door you want to pass and find that it's shut or locked. You can't open it. For anyone who's ever been confined in jail or elsewhere, you also know that it's a terrible thing to hear a door you can't open lock behind you, or to face a wall with no doors at all. When doors open up for us, that's a good thing, isn't it? We use words about doors opening to speak of situations when we don't solve whatever problems we've been facing by our own efforts. It just seems to happen, and the new possibilities unfold. Even if the way is not completely certain, there now seems to at least be a way to go. Religious people often use words about God opening doors for them as a way to speak about God's grace. The door was shut, but God opened it for me. This can be more of a figure than a figure of speech. The Christian apostle Paul is said to have once been imprisoned together with his companions. They sang praises to God until, lo and behold, a violent earthquake caused the doors of the prison to burst open. Well, believe it or not, it's no surprise to read about such a thing in a religious scripture. The scripture of Islam, the Quran, speaks a language very much like that of the Bible and has almost the same cast of characters. Adam and Eve, Noah and Abraham, Jesus and Mary, and so on. So you'll probably not be surprised to learn that this book also speaks of paradise opening its doors to the faithful, or that the Prophet Muhammad instructed believers to say, "Oh God, open the doors of your mercy for me," whenever they entered a mosque, and to exit with the words, "O God, I ask for your grace." But there are some words, here are some words about open doors that we might find startling from the sixth chapter of that book. Their hearts have hardened, and the devil has stylishly dressed up for them what they have done. And so when they forgot what they'd been reminded of, we opened upon them the doors to all things until, when they were rejoicing in all they accomplished, we took them suddenly and eliminated their hope. Suddenly, these words about open doors do not seem to be speaking of grace. Or maybe they are. The Arabic says literally, "We opened the doors upon them," or "on them." But what does it mean to open doors on someone? Let's try to open these words up a little more after our hearts are opened by Deborah's music. Thank you. Well, we didn't plan that, but for those of you who know the song, Sweet Low, Sweet Chariot, there's a band of angels in it. There will be some angels in this talk, but Deborah and I did not confer about this. When can open doors mean not deliverance, but disaster? Well, unless you were raised without TV or movies, you've seen this happen in cartoons 100 times. The big bad wolf is straining to get through the door of a house in order to eat Little Red Riding Hood, or the three little pigs, or maybe it's Elmer Fudd come to kill that wascally wabbit Bugs Bunny. Bang, 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 push, sub, strain, go get that giant Acme battering ram to break down the door, when suddenly someone inside throws it open. The intruder flies through the house, unable to check the speed of his entry. In he goes, straight through the house, right out the back door, over the cliff, or into the jaws of a much, much bigger and badder creature. Ah! The look of triumph changes at once to horror, or shock and awe, if you prefer those words. Or you might prefer these. We opened upon them the doors to all things, until, when they were rejoicing in all they accomplished, we took them suddenly and eliminated their hope. Though it's hardly a Looney Tune, there is a grim humor here. When the exaltation of easy entry, taking house after house, is turned into despair. Words about God opening all doors for us may speak of God's grace, but to speak of all the doors suddenly opening on us is another matter entirely. This may still be a moment of grace, but it's a moment of grace delivered tactically. God may still be our gracious God, but now when he takes us, we're not lifted or freed, we're taken down by this tactical grace. God seems to be saying, I do not close my hand to strike, but I open it profoundly. I give you access to all things all at once, much more than you can bear. I deliver the world from my hand to yours and its weight to your shoulders. Some of you might have seen the movie Bruce Almighty, where Morgan Freeman, who's always God, makes Jim Carrey God for a certain length of time. And of course, that's overpowering. He's overcome by that. When you go through doors that you don't have to open yourself, you don't really learn how to do it. And then what happens if they close behind you? When every door is an entrance, there's really no exit. The doors open on us, and on we must go. Where we might stop, nobody knows. Maybe we can never stop. This is not so much an ironic way to lose as a terrifying way to win. Be it a battle, a war, or even an election. What is gained may turn to loss of even what you had before. Religious scriptures do some of their most important work when they reflect upon such false triumphs, missions only seemingly accomplished. And they try to give us a heads up about others yet to come. Here the Quran shares its vision of God's grace used as a weapon of mass instruction. We see how the doors to all things might open on us violently as we are sucked into an imploding vacuum, a black hole. At the moment when every door opens, our hopes are dashed away. Their hearts have hardened. The devil has stylishly dressed up for them what they've done. And so when they forgot what they'd been reminded of, we opened upon them the doors to all things until we took them suddenly and eliminated their hope. There's no good English translation for the Arabic verb bulisa that's used in this passage. I've rendered its meaning as to eliminate hope, but it can also mean to be made to despair or even to bedevil. The personal name of the devil in the Quran is Iblis. It's derived from this same hopeless word. Iblis means hopelessness or despair. The name tells you a lot about the Quran's notion of the devil, who's also called things like the slurker, the slinker, the whisperer. There is no great Satan in original Islam. That modern slogan is not to be found in the Quran or in any of Islam's sacred literature. The devil is not the great rival or enemy of God, but rather of human beings. And he's much, much more desperate than mighty or powerful. Here's the story of how he got to be that way. God made the angels from fire long before making human beings from earth. They were beautiful. But one was more beautiful than all the others. He was the most knowledgeable angel and the most zealous in his worship of God. Or you could say that he was the most fervently religious angel, if you can imagine one angel being more religious than another. His name at that time was Azazil. Aloofness, or isolation, or we could combine these two ideas and translate his name as arrogance. The angels enjoyed thousands of years of privilege as the only beings with whom God would have conversations as they circled his throne in worship, glorifying and praising him. And then, for some reason, some crazy reason, God decided to make a new kind of talking creature. Any guesses? Us, people. He started with Adam, the father of all, shaping him from clay of several colors, which accounts for the different skin tones of his offspring today. God did not finish the human being all at once, but he left his clay body lying someplace where the angels would pass it by for 40 days or 40 years, according to different narrators. One version tells us when the angels passed it by, they were frightened by what they saw. The angel most frightened was Azazil, the most beautiful angel. He would kick it and make the body produce sounds. Groans or echoes, we don't know. But finally, one day, he decided to inspect the clay man more closely and, quote, entered Adam's mouth and left from his posterior. Then he entered his posterior and left from his mouth. When he came out, he said to Adam, "What were you created for?" Pointing at the clay man, he joked to the other angels, "Don't be afraid of that one. For your Lord is solid, whereas this one is hollow." Hollow. He was sure from his probing that the man was empty. "Look at him. Do you see that guy? He's all like hollow." But little does this angel know, as he comes out, whichever end it was, that he will be the butt of the joke at the end of the story. Because just then, God filled the hollow part of Adam with his own breath, just like in the Bible. Next, God commanded the angels to bow before his newest creation, but the most beautiful angel refused. Why should fire bow to hollow earth, pure energy to lumpy matter? He had found no resistance while passing through Adam, and so concluded that he was empty. That was his judgment upon us all. And I should tell you that this judgment, that a simple, naked human being was not worth the respect of angels, was the original sin, according to Islam. Let me repeat, violation of human dignity was the original sin. You remember Abu Ghraib prison, right? Abu Ghraib and all those photos. You remember the families in handcuffs just a couple weeks ago at our airport. You remember our last presidential campaign. Please don't forget. Humiliation of a human being via the openings of the body, call it waterboarding or something, quote, much worse, repeats the particulars of the original sin, intentionally or not. Whether we do it on our own or under orders from above, we who would be angels in the world's eyes are behaving from this perspective exactly like the devil. Not great Satans, just dirty little stinkers. As punishment for such behavior, God bedeviled the most beautiful angel, the first among angels, and he became Iblis, the one for whom hope has been eliminated. Azazel, isolation, arrogance, has become despair. He met no resistance in the prone human figure. All doors, front and back, were thrown open for him to take a little cakewalk, which quickly changed into something else. First, no resistance, and now there is no hope for him. It makes me wonder. Maybe hope is a form of resistance to the arrogance that says my kind matters more than your kind does, has greater light or higher purpose. Hope is resistance to the judgment that a human being can be empty of value. That's the real meaning of the first Unitarian Universalist principle, of our covenant to affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person. These words don't just express a good idea. They are words of resistance, not a proposition to be analyzed, but a radical hope to proclaim that there is inherent worth and dignity to each and every person, no matter what we find or think we fail to find when we probe their minds or bodies. Don't be seduced by the devil's judgment that a human being can be hollow. That hollow space is where God's breath enters. Listen now. You could cover your ears if you want. Listen to it now. Coming in and going out. Down and up and down and up. But listen carefully. Iblis may not kick us, but his whispers can trick us, smooth as silk with expert timing. The Quran says their hearts have hardened and the devil has stylishly dressed up for them what they have done. Arrogance was his downfall. But remember that he's a former archangel, a master at glorification and praise, so good at it that at first his work even satisfied God. He's a clever salesman and can speak with that angel's accent when he wants to sell his bill of goods. All he needs is to get a whisper of himself going inside of us, where it can start an echo and maybe push God's breath right out. Do you think that could happen? The Quran is always addressed simultaneously to the individual and the community. This is true of most religious scriptures. Here's our verse about open doors again, plus the next one that I haven't read aloud till now. Their hearts have hardened. The devil has stylishly dressed up for them what they've done. And so when they forgot what they'd been reminded of, we opened upon them the doors to all things. We took them suddenly and eliminated their hope. And thus was the dabir of the community that mistreated others cut off. The Arabic word dabir can mean a root or origin. It can mean bygone times or past or history. So this community upon which the doors have been opened so suddenly may find itself not just disconnected from its historical roots, but also starving its flower, its buds, its future. Azazel, the most beautiful and religious angel, became Iblis. Arrogance became hopelessness. And now this angel turned devil has led a community away from the best part of itself, from its noble roots and its tender promise. If he can get us to mutilate ourselves, maybe he'll feel beautiful again by comparison. He feels so ugly now. Poor, sick fellow. So much wasted talent. So desperate for love. Our religious community branches from roots in the universalist tradition. Our universalist forebears rejected the notion that God divides us into the saved and the damned as a worldview that enabled arrogance for the few and despair in all others. They rejected ideas like hell and eternal damnation and also the existence of a personal devil. There's no real angel who became a real devil any more than there was a real tooth witch who became the tooth fairy. Not if we mean by devil either the chief or the only member of some demonic supernatural species. But we can think instead of Iblis as the perennial voice of both arrogance and hopelessness, speaking now in whispers, now in hollow slogans, saying the same things to so many of us over so many centuries, that it does seem to have a life of its own. And so we can think of God as the radical voice and the living breath of hope. When they forgot what they'd been reminded of, we opened upon them the doors to all things. That's the bad news. The good news is that when someone tells us that we've forgotten what we've been reminded of, we have the opportunity to remember again. The Quran says that the people in question forgot, past tense. It's not trying to provoke despair, but to jog our memories and get us back on track. It's not trying to slam doors in our face, but to hold one open, just a clear, bright crack, and shine a light inside. Our scripture offers moments of tactical grace that can open hearts and minds, but not an infinite number of these moments. We have an opportunity now, but not necessarily forever. Change is possible, yes, but change is also urgent. When a religious scripture cuts through our defenses to awaken this sense of both possibility and urgency, to soften and move our hearts before they harden completely, then it's done its job. If I've opened the doors of this scripture so it can speak to you a little, then likewise, I've done mine. What your job is, only you.